Tune in to The Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM, and be part of an in-depth discussion on events you didn't know you needed to hear until you do, from Namibia, Africa, and around the world. Tune in from Monday to Friday from 4:30 to 6 p.m. only on Eagle FM.
Good afternoon. A good Monday afternoon, and welcome to Home Run. Today's Kasinga Day, a remembrance. Yeah, I tend to mix up when words when I'm describing holidays. Yeah.
Why? What happened, Helmut?
You say Kasinga Day celebration, remembrance. Yeah. I'd go with remembrance over celebration.
Yeah.
Yeah, because of the, it's in remembrance for those that were lost in the fight and pursuit of the freedom that we are now enjoying. Thanks to them, you have a lot of people now standing in front of police officers saying, "I know my rights." Yeah, so...
You know, that statement is still inflammatory, né? Because it doesn't inflame you, the person saying, "I know my rights." Mm-hmm. It inflames the other side.
Police officer.
Yeah, from acting in a very flammable...
Yeah, I'm told they take it, depending on the time of the month, they will take it it sounds flammable, incendiary, in the middle of the month, but if it's somewhere around the 20th, they'll just laugh about it. Yeah, like, that's funny. You just don't try that. Don't try that. Yeah. Today's discussion here on Home Run, wherever you're tuned in, thank you for joining us, because today we're going to talk about infrastructure development across the continent. How are things going? And are we doing it the right way? Now, I came to that question of are we doing it the right way because of the speech that was given, because of the speech that was given by one Miss un momento, s'il vous plaît. One Miss, is it Doctor? No, not Doctor. It's Miss Nados Bekele Thomas, who is the CEO of the African Union Development Agency. Mm. Now, this was given at Africa's STC T&E session, the fifth session. Now, all those abbreviations basically adds up to a Specialized Technical Committee on Transport and Energy. Now, these guys. This is basically composed of ministerial, or more like Africa's government representatives. And what they do is their mandate is to make decisions that provides policy guidance and strategic oversight on the continent's integration in terms of infrastructure and energy. Infrastructure, transport, and energy.
Mm.
Eish. Now, the reason why I just went straight to Miss Nados Bekele Thomas is because she made, she gave about 15, 20 minutes. That's how, 15, 16 minutes. That's how long her speech was. But she made one very important point that made me listen to the whole thing and on repeat, especially the part of a speech. Now, the point she made was that yes, there's to some degree significant infrastructure development taking place on the African continent, and this is the infrastructure in terms of energy and also infrastructure in terms of transport. But this infrastructure development, both in energy and transport, seems to be not in sync with the economic plans that we have.
And that's why I love it, what she said, Hamoud. But obviously, it depends on who she's saying it to. Mm-hmm. Who's receiving the message. What's her name again? Bekele Thomas, right?
Yeah.
So I'm going to start from back... from the close to the end of her speech, heading to the forefront.
Yeah.
So, Bekele Thomas stated, building a highway that doesn't connect hubs, business hubs, trade hubs, with other trade hubs and business hubs, just makes it a highway, makes it a useless highway. If a railway doesn't lead to a, you know, doesn't connect energy infrastructure, then it looks purely extractive. So what is she saying? Specifically, South Africa is the best template for this. Yeah. So South Africa still has all those coal power, power stations that Eskom owns, right? Mm-hmm. But all the coal mines in the Mpumalanga region, the Mpumalanga province of South Africa,
yeah,
is connected to all the coal power stations of South Africa. So if a road or railway line doesn't connect from the energy extraction site to the energy generation site, then it looks purely extractive.
Yeah.
For example, Zambia's copper driving on trucks through Namibia, through Walvis Bay out to the world.
Mm.
The other point you also highlighted is the fragmentation that you cited is also a fragmentation scenario that looks like this. Why are we so easy as Africans to first think about the European and the North American market by selling them products first before selling it to each other? For example, look at tourism. Mm-hmm. Helmut, why does it cost 15,000 Namibian dollars to fly from Windhoek to Berlin or Frankfurt?
Right.
But it costs you 30,000 Namibian dollars to fly from Windhoek to Tunis in Tunisia, and you have to spend 36 hours in flight
connecting
while in movement with the connectors. Why do you almost need to spend a day and a half more to fly on the continent versus for you to fly from Windhoek to Germany? She says, you know, it's a wonderful statement she's saying.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing that we also have to understand. First and foremost, who do we connect who to with? Because currently on the continent, our politics is also not sorted.
Oh no.
There's very few Africans that want to travel. Helmut, go and ask yourself. Yes, the British now have their own xenophobia happening there in Europe situations there. But, the concern here is, that if you look inside of Europe, the Europeans are moving everywhere. It's one of the reasons as to why some of the Pan-African politicians were complaining just after COVID about this remove the border discussion. You know, the open border policy that they were pushing for.
Yeah.
Because if the Europeans are doing it between each other, the South Americans are doing it between each other, you'll find Uruguayans, Paraguayans, Argentines, Brazilians crisscrossing across the borders. To you, it's just a line on the sand. But why is it when you come to Africa, it's literally a passport that you need? It's literally a permission you need.
Yeah.
So, and then she cited, Bekele Thomas cited the infrastructure development between China and the three.
And Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. Yeah.
What happened there? They all connected these three countries to each other. Historically, China does have a shared cultural and historic relevance with those three countries.
Yeah.
Ne? And she highlighted that infrastructure crisscrosses the borders between China and these three countries. And then these three countries connect each other as well because it's all about firstly connecting trade, secondly connecting then the people who trade between each other. And then obviously, you know, just trying to, I don't want to say you bring some future elements to your transport, but you are improving the transport aspect of things. You know, you're increasing the volumes that you can move. You're increasing the amount of trucks that can travel on your infrastructure. You're making sure people are connected. They travel more. All of this is happening at a fraction of the price. But then you come to Africa, 54 different countries on one continent, but all acting in 54 different directions. How do we get there?
I know, right? Like the layout, if you look at it, I think that layout is the one that we are basically replicating in our attempt to implement the Africa Continental Free Trade Area, because she also, she also pointed to that. Now, the thing is, we have on paper the Africa Continental Free Trade Area. The connectivity is awesome on paper, except when you look at the infrastructure that's supposed to basically bring that theory that's on the document of the documents of everything, that speaks to intercontinental, trade.
Mm.
What's on paper in terms of implementation of the Africa Continental Free Trade, in theory, it's not it's not in sync with the infrastructure development and energy development, especially in terms of energy and transport and trade on the continent.
Yeah.
You have, you have the theory of the Africa Continental Free Trade Area going west, and you have the implementation of the infrastructure that's supposed to bring the theory to life going east.
Yeah.
And we meet every year and, speech after speech. Don't worry, by 2063. Oh, seriously?
We are going to do this. We're going to be united. And then someone decides to go have a civil war because the incumbent administration didn't want to accept election results. It's always about elections. That's why elections in Africa, Helmut, is always, for some reason, is viewed with this sort of suspicion / anxiety / we must be nervous / we don't know what's going to happen / we don't trust each other / but when you go to Europe, when you go to the UK,
mm-hmm.
they don't care who you vote for. Helmut, do you know what was one of the best examples I've ever seen?
Yeah.
Specifically around elections. Because it's only in Africa where people get sensitive about elections. Only in Africa.
Because we have turned the politics into a career.
Not for the politician. You're explaining the politician. We're talking about the electorate. The electorate
mm-hmm.
is on a scenario of there's some sort of punitive action. Some sort of, you will be punished if you voted for the wrong side.
Yeah.
Without respecting, you made a decision. You like this person's proposals on policy, on various policy issues, and you have been rewarded.
Mm-hmm.
If you voted the opposite way, tough luck. Unfortunately, you just made a bad choice. But that's it. That's what democracy is about. You select which one you feel needs to be.
On that subject, dude, a lot of African countries have, including Namibia, have exactly. democracy.
Yeah.
But believe me, a lot of homesteads have dictatorship. Careful of who you vote for. Their homesteads that will punish
that is true.
You
yeah.
because you voted for someone they don't approve. You
yeah.
have grandfathers, fathers, mothers, and aunties who will punish you. I know one friend who told me that, he grew up in a homestead like that.
Yeah.
If your parents find out, you're supporting a different political party.
Mm.
It's World War III in that house.
Yeah.
So in other words, you have a country is under democracy, but domestically.
Household wise. On the micro level.
On the micro level.
Things are not democratic.
There's
a whole bunch of authoritarianism taking place.
Punitive measure includes starvation dishes that comes with you.
Eviction notices.
Eviction notices. Forget notice, just a straight up eviction.
Even literally being banned from coming close to the kitchen.
Uh-huh.
Or any other presence where said particular household authority is present in the household.
Punishment.
So, I've heard about them, Helmut. I've heard about them. Or it would also be other punitive measures, for example, like, the discussions that our colleague Anakleta discovered happening in the Kavango East region. Where, and remember the standing committee, the National Council standing committee last year,
mm-hmm.
where the extension office, the regional authorities lady explained, since they budgeted for this community's project to be funded for this year, mm-hmm. now the other community hears that this project is being funded here,
yeah.
then now suddenly political accusations start rising up from that other community. Remember that story?
Yeah.
And those other communities, then she said, then the other communities are like, yeah, it's because you guys voted for that party or that local councillor or this and that. And they're always involving said particular well, unproven, but highly suspicious, you know, and they're obviously highly suspicious of a process because they've not been educated. Now, what is the biggest concern? This means, Hamoud, even on another micro level, which is local authority and regional authority wise, the people who work in these institutions in, like in Namibia, don't communicate to the communities that they represent. So if you're a regional council.
I think they do, but every 5 years, like once every 5 years.
Which is poor communication, which you know is poor communication.
Yeah, terrible, yeah.
Yeah. So how can you expect if a person doesn't, is not fully comprehensible or fully, they don't have a full command of English to watch the president reading a speech in full English on an internet platform, which the person doesn't, can't even afford internet with. They'd probably just have a Tamagotchi.
The first question is, do they stay in an area that has internet
electricity? Do they have a place?
Oh, it's with electricity.
Electricity.
And we are back at energy infrastructure.
Once again. So, we sit with a headache in terms of, firstly, solving the basic burdens. I'm now calling it the basic burdens in life, in development.
Yeah.
Because the basic burdens in development, Helmut, is we need to look at things through, for example, what the closest economies to like us, Africa, who are currently pivoting and positioning themselves around themselves. We need to look at the roadmap they walked.
Yeah.
The pathway they walked. How to avoid the not so good things in their paths.
Blocks they went through.
Yeah. That led them to where they currently are. Is it a satisfactory level that they currently find themselves in? Or is it not a satisfactory level? Helmut, here's, and this is the worst case scenario. Oh, there's one or two people I've heard who have highlighted the policy making that we've got, for example, like in a Namibian context, is for a developed country. Remember?
So we just adopted something that...
Or we're trying to please somebody to meet certain particular goals, but the goals don't correspond with the needs on the ground. Look, I'm not saying go full on, you know, completely bonkers in terms of being completely corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
But Germany has corruption.
Oh, every country has corruption.
Every country has corruption. But here's the particular concern. Don't just copy and paste something from somewhere else. Just put on a fancy letterhead and a foot, you know, a header and a footer at the bottom of the document to try and make it look like it's your own idea and then present it as your own. No. For things, for example, like with the GDPR, things that we don't produce. We don't produce the internet on Africa. We don't. I believe a country like Namibia should have just copied the GDPR for its data protection, cybersecurity, and what's the other one? Data protection, cybersecurity, and access to information. We should have just copied the GDPR like that. Ne?
Yeah, because plus the GDPR is a template.
Yeah.
That you can just play around it, so, you know, to suit your, you know, your conditions.
Exactly. And the GDPR speaks literally to what Namibia wants to achieve. In the remember when we did the GDPR last year?
Yeah.
By looking at its essence and specifically the other law that they were going to bring out, the one based upon, what was that law's name? That internet regulation law that the European Union brought out. That became active this year, but no, it became active last year, but it was literally signed or gazetted in 2024. The concern from that was, Helmut, it's not the funny business that you see here in Namibia, where we gazette a law and then no budget is allocated to establishing the authority, which is mentioned in the piece of document.
Mm.
And then it takes 5-10 years for the authority to be established. And it's just hanging loosely. This law is just hanging there loosely. For example, the Whistleblower Act. Right?
Oh, yeah.
It's been gazetted in 2018 or 2017.
2017.
But there's supposed to be also a government unit that needs to be established for it to be fully operational. The Access to Information Act. It needs also another government unit to be established and to be promoted, which is independent from MICT or any other ministry, because it that's what it is. They apparently retracted the vacancy notice
for
the commissioner and the deputy commissioner. they must need to appoint the two commissioners.
For the whistleblower, I get it.
For the access to information. For the information commissioner.
Uh-huh.
The vacancy was retracted. The notice. Because it apparently needs to be, you know, revisited. But here's the thing, Helmut. When we look at lawmaking and lawmaking that has to bring about the operation of an entity, a legal entity into the Namibian economy specifically, the concern is, like in a Namibian space, slow movements are happening. We are too slow. When you come to the European Union, yes, I know I'm talking about the EU and comparing a 27 members nation body with a single Namibian economy. Well, it's because Namibia chose to act this way. Namibia is not working through the AU to deal with the EU. It's Namibia's own problem. It's Namibia's own problem. We don't even work through SADC to talk to the EU. Namibia has chosen to work to talk directly to the EU, to talk directly to Germany, to talk directly to France and whoever. But those guys are talking through the EU to Namibia. Helmut? They are doing it. So if we're going to...
Aren't they also doing it like in terms of negotiations on other initiatives, like directly? Like as in individual countries?
I'll take you back to the three COP events after from 2021. Remember, in 2021, we heard about green hydrogen for the first time. In every Namibian's life, we heard about green hydrogen. That happened after the UN General Assembly that President Geingob went to. He took, who was the guy that he took with? The two ministers. It wasn't Minister Tomalwendo.
Oh, is the one in Glasgow?
He took a minister with, and I think the Director General of National Planning at the time, Obed Kanjose.
There's one that Tomalwendo stated, because I remember when the King of Belgium came here, when he was explaining.
Yeah, so that was 2024.
When he was explaining, like, the whole, you know, like, historical reference in terms of COP and energy transition that brought about the green hydrogen discussion.
Yeah. So now you get the gist of that roadmap.
Yeah.
But when we look at the actual roadmap of interaction between Namibia and whoever these entities are. So 2021 is the first time because President Geingob made the famous speech of Namibia is going into green hydrogen.
Yeah.
2021. 2022 comes about. The Russia-Ukraine war starts unraveling and things are happening. And then we hear again about, that's the first time that we start hearing about oil and gas and the explorations here taking place in the south were announced in 2022. And then there was the particular national sort of like information session that President Geingob also once again gave from State House, where they were talking about, you know, the oil, green hydrogen once again, and the, you know, what to look forward to in terms of the oncoming conference of parties. Because there was a conference of party in 2021 in Glasgow?
Yeah, it was in Glasgow.
In Glasgow?
2021.
Green hydrogen was mentioned there once again, because President Geingob went there. And then they mentioned again in 2022. President Geingob went to the second one. It was the one in Glasgow went to
Egypt.
Yeah, went to Egypt.
Yeah.
Sharm el-Sheikh, that was the place.
Yeah. From Egypt, that's when it went to Qatar.
Qatar, yeah. And Qatar went
Qatar Azerbaijan.
Was it Azerbaijan? Azerbaijan would have been 2024.
Yeah, so you're looking at 26 Glasgow, 27 Egypt, 28.
Yeah, because last year was Brazil.
Last year was Brazil.
Yeah. So, and President Bumba was at 2024's one.
I only remember President Bumba attending Africa-Russia Summit.
Yeah, but you remember his, that was vice president.
Oh, yeah, that was
him as vice president. Because from
the relationship between Namibia and Russia.
Oh no, he didn't attend that one. It was minister at Azerbaijan. It was minister of environment, Boamba Shifeta.
Oh yeah.
Because he went to the two COP events, the one that was in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia and the Azerbaijan one, conference of parties for the overall climate agreement, climate negotiations. Where he repeated basically the same speech about operationalize the disaster. What is that? The loss and damage fund. The promises that the major economies of the world have made need to operationalize the loss and damage fund.
They really look at developed countries also sort of like they gave a lot of faith to a lot of developing countries in 2015 during the Paris agreements because they made a lot of promises about this is the transition that we're going to take in terms of energy from the non-renewable to renewable, from fossil fuel as we move to the to environmentally friendly modes of energy. One of the things they made was they acknowledged was that developed countries will assist developing countries in the funding of their energy transition, and now you have the guy said during the the Italy Africa summit saying, well, you have to implement
2024.
January 2024, and now you have to
let your money do the talking.
Enough talking. That coming from the that coming from a politician is so rich.
No, that coming from an African politician is so rich, even worse. But because Hamid, the reason why I explained or outlined how Africa needs to look at its development pathway was, and you cited the fragmentation.
Yeah.
We have to look at things, Helmut, like Namibia has decided to make its own bed by talking directly to the EU, which is a 27-member nation entity.
And then the individual countries
in that 27-member cluster. Because when I say the GDPR would have been, we just change a few words here and there, substitute EU with Namibia and all those. You know, you do that funny editing little things. You don't go and write a completely different document that comes from the UN perspective. But when what was the lady that did the presentation for the cybersecurity bill? The lady from the Ministry of Justice's legal. What's that? From the drafting division, the law drafting, not law reform. The other one that does the legal drafts, that sign up, that you know, put the words together and the sentences and stuff. I'm making it sound like a manufacturing site. So when she explained literally, because I keep forgetting her surname, is because she had it wasn't a very popular surname. Hence the reason it keeps flying off my head.
Mm-hmm.
But when she explained, literally, when I asked her the question of, why did we go the UN route? And when you go read up about the cybersecurity, it's known as a convention, the UN Convention on Cybersecurity. It was the Russians that proposed, that let this thing cascade down from the UN into the countries, which is how lawmaking now suddenly pops up. But here's the thing. It's up to the country to define certain particular things, clauses, and so on in their context of how they perceive impact of cybersecurity activity on their citizens and in their country. But here's the downside, Helmut. We all know that the internet was created by the Americans.
Yeah.
The World Wide Web was created by an Englishman who decided to build this platform on top of the internet that the Americans built. So, if you are using English today as a means of communication in Namibia, you cannot say this is Namibian. This language is known as Namibian.
No.
This language is known as English.
It's in the name.
So, we adopted it. It comes from England. Now, for the explanation I got that day from the executive director of MICT, Madam Linda Nakale, who said, no, Namibia wants to contain an aspect of sovereignty in terms of its own cybersecurity law.
Right.
But here's the thing, Helmut. We don't produce the internet. We didn't even build the cables connecting Namibia to North America and to Europe. WAX literally comes out of London. Its starting point is out of London. Because WAX is like a European venture, but there's two Google cables connecting to Africa, one Meta cable connecting to Africa. We don't have the money, literally, like Madam Bekele Thomas said, we have accumulated money
now it's offshore
in like from the pensions that started growing, because obviously we're starting to have this, these booms of working populations across the continent.
Yeah.
And, but the pensions are moving in different directions. Yeah. You don't hear the American pension operating in Russia. You don't hear the Chinese state pension operating in Australia. It stays in its country and it acts in its country and it invests in its country. For the reason being that I also can't understand why some of the financial journalists in Namibia always find fault with the presence of GIPF in the Namibian economy. Helmut, go and look at most of these investment houses. Those, many of these investment houses only became alive. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't hollow entities with no business activity. They only became alive because of GIPF. Meaning the GIPF said, listen guys, we need to find investment avenues.
Yeah.
There is nothing wrong with, if you've got a parent or family member that works in the government,
mm-hmm.
being a salient or quiet investor in the private economy. It's a template that exists the world over.
Yeah.
Government pensions are financing private sector endeavors from the United States to Australia, to China, to Japan, to Europe. There is no problem, Helmut. The private sector in any Puritan perspective, and I say Puritan with a sense of the people who want the purest capitalism to flourish.
Oh, yeah, right.
They depend, guess what? On government pension money investments. They depend on it. Helmut, do you know, have you ever watched the TV series, I almost said Breaking Bad, but that's the worst example because I never watched Breaking Bad. Have you ever watched the TV series, I just want to get its name, but it's literally about an investment company. The lead actor is an Englishman, obviously, but the gist of it was they were all competing for the American pension fund. It's one Ooh. Pension fund, the 401k or 401 something K. Helmut, it is a ton of money. Do you know why I know about this? Because I watch senators. There's a senator in the U.S. Senate or a congressman in the U.S. Congress. Now, every day they come for their sessions. It's empty. Homeboy sits with like these big poster placards mm-hmm. talking about the debt servicing of the U.S. government, of the U.S. economy. And every time he says, that's the actor's name, Damian Lewis. Every time he says, the debt servicing or the borrowing against the American pension fund, it's like a massive pension fund,
yeah.
is a problem. And it's a problem that's eroding the level by which whoever is borrowing the money against this pension fund is becoming more severe. Now, obviously, you and I know about the petrodollar. That's the reason why the Iranians are literally bombing all the other Arab League nations, right?
Yeah.
Because what the Americans do is the Americans allow those OPEC members who Iran are attacking to literally, and to who Iran is also blockading, to literally weaken the U.S. dollar. So it was an attack on the global economy, like Shui Qin explained. It's an attack on the global economy because the global economy is run by the petrodollar. The petrodollar is literally oils for US dollars. That's it. That's what the Americans are literally printing money on. They're printing it on the money that these Arab League nations are literally producing, which is oil.
Look, the more you point out things like that, and the more I actually come to learn more about the global financial architecture. It's
the TV show's name is Billions, literally by the name Billions. Have you ever seen Billions?
Oh, I have seen Billions.
Do you remember now that Damian Lewis's character, the CEO,
Bobby Axelrod,
kept targeting, and sometimes in some episodes he mentions the American pension fund.
Mm-hmm.
It's this massive government pension fund that is this massive anchor in the US economy. That's it, Helmut. You'll find the same template in Australia,
mm-hmm.
in South Africa, in even now in Namibia. You'll find it in the UK. You'll find it in Russia. You'll find it in China. This massive collection of government money, just pension money from the pensioners.
Yeah.
From the government workers. It's literally sitting there influencing and investing in private sector. So it's private sector working for public sector. Now again, let us please ask the fundamental question. What is wrong with government investing in private sector?
If you have seen how the Americans solved the 2008 financial crisis, how they bailed out a bunch of their private...
And they didn't have to do it.
No, they didn't have to.
They didn't have to do it.
They just didn't want, and I didn't know that until you pointed out, they didn't want some foreign multinationals basically coming into, to take over that market if they allowed their private to go down under.
They did. They offered, they went to the Chinese.
Yeah, the Lehman Brothers were not to...
Lehman Brothers were the
were out
first...
out of luck on that.
They were the first sacrificial lamb.
Sacrificial lamb, yeah, that's the...
They were the first... Let's identify some of the facts. They were the first sacrificial lamb, meaning under Barack Obama's administration, whoever his Federal Reserve chief was and his Secretary of Commerce and his Secretary of Finance... They went like, nah, we're not touching the Lehman Brothers. But when they saw...
Were they like the primary players in all the chaos? So why were they just thrown under the bus?
It was them, the Bank of America, which is not just for you listeners to understand, it's not a central bank. The American central bank is the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
So Bank of America, it was Bank of America, it was the Lehman Brothers, it was Morgan Stanley. Who is the Chase one? It's Chase Morgan Stanley, right? Or Morgan Stanley Chase? Because they changed their name now to just Chase something. The bank, that bank. Chase changed its name now after the financial crash. It was Morgan Stanley Chase. And it was... What's the other bank's name? It was another bank. What is that bank's name? Citibank.
Why is Citibank everywhere? I'm reading on Haiti, Citibank is there.
part of those cluster of American banks, right? But yeah. The Lehman Brothers was the one more severely hit. Then they saw what the chain reaction was. Now, the banks have insurance from the insurance companies for the money.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, so the product that they sold, which was the housing mortgages to people who can't afford the housing mortgages, was insured with the insurance companies. So every product you sell, you insure with your insurance company.
Hence the mortgage-backed security.
Yeah. So when the client started defaulting on repayments...
They couldn't afford the...
Yeah, and because of the
properties they were sold.
Yeah, and because of
something that they knew after doing their analysis that, you know what, looking at the income,
these people don't qualify. Yeah,
looking at the income and the price of this property, there is no way this person can afford it. So they sold it to them anyway.
Yeah, and under any other analysis, this person would not have been cleared for a home loan, but they still did went for it.
Aren't there, why were we having this conversation in 2008? Aren't there supposed to be regulations in place that should be against that? Like,
What was the regulation that happened? With, if you ever watch any of Gary Stevenson's, podcasts on YouTube, this was the guy that I cite.
Yeah.
Gary has a master's in economics, just so that we know. So, but because Gary speaks like us ordinary people.
Yeah.
Because he is
speaking from any official position where all protocol must be observed.
And he's also not obfuscating facts, meaning he leaves out certain important, relevant pieces of information in his conversations. Now, Gary cited Helmut. He made, what was it? From the 2008 financial crash.
Yeah.
Gary, as a 25-year-old Citibank or Citigroup trader in London, he made something like, was it 40 million? No. His first bonus from betting on a default happening. It was like £400,000. His bonus alone. And because what he explained was a situation of Dwight, he literally told the person that was interviewing him, he felt bad because he comes out of this, very working class, suburb or neighborhood of London.
Mm-hmm.
He says it's East London, then he mentions. And his buddies are all doing like an electrician, a plumber, a bartender, nightclub bouncer. The other one just goes from odd job to odd job lifestyle.
Yeah.
And they get happy. He literally said he felt so bad. His friends get happy because he was like a 22-year-old guy. His friends get happy at £1,000 as a bonus.
Yeah.
Now, £1,000 to you and me is $20,000 yeah. as a bonus. So I would also be super happy. Maar nog steeds. Getting back. So when he got his first like serious bonus paycheck, £400,000. He said he didn't know what to do with the money. He didn't know how to react. He couldn't tell his dad because he knew his dad was a working man, from a working class background. His dad was a post office worker.
Mm-hmm.
His dad was part of the last generation, you know, the people that didn't have to go to university. That
just pure technical skills.
You've just finished high school and you just get any job that is there and you stay in that job for life.
Mm-hmm.
And his mom was a stay at home mom. And, you know, things were literally just, you know, like typically working class settings.
Yeah.
And Gary explained that specifically in that scenario, because, you know, the particular picture from that is there is money that is present that is being earned on a different side of the same city versus money that you've known. Now, I'm talking about earnings, meaning in terms of the sense of income.
Yeah.
But what Gary highlighted was, yes, in the world of the financial markets, the commercial banks are betting on policies. And they are betting on certain things happening. So, for example, if our president at the State of the Nation address goes and says, we are going to build more roads, then the banks align all financial products and assets closer to saying, hey, listen, you, the construction company, there's this lovely below prime or whatever percentage that they give on interest of whatever product for you to access for your business to go into that business, to go in that avenue. But we want our return. Don't worry. We'll hit you at the end. It looks good here in the front, but at the end, you've got to pay something.
Yeah.
That's the situation. And Gary them were literally betting on certain things not going also straight. He says it in his own words.
It's people are betting on war.
Yeah. He says it in his own, like that soldier that now is being... the American government is still deciding, should we arrest the soldier or not for the attack on Venezuela?
Oh, yeah.
You heard about the guy that made $200,000.
Yeah.
He was a soldier from the U.S. Army. Homeboy went and announced it. I would have just gone like, oh my goodness. That means I have to go to work. just go collect your money. Stay silent. And, just.
Wasn't it in Israel where one cameraman was, you know, where a bunch of angry betting guys were looking for a cameraman because he took a video of a bomb falling on the part they had, you know.
Oh yeah, I heard that.
Earlier that the bomb was not going to fall on that part.
And they had a dispute between themselves. Why did it fall there? Not. No, but wasn't because they confirmed. But the cameraman actually confirmed the event.
Yeah, he was just doing his job.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, he made a film. While filming, he took a video.
Mm.
He took a video of a bomb falling on a, you know, just what he thought maybe was just a random building or a random part of town.
Yeah.
Only to find out that there are people that have spent literal millions of US dollars betting that a bomb was not going to fall on that particular area. And now they were mad at him.
Look. You know, I should access that betting scenario.
Look,
I just imagine to yourself, I'm a $200,000 just like that for the next war.
But betting on war is savage.
No, it is. No, no, it actually is. It actually is. But that's what I learned from Gary Hamwood. Look, there's a reason why I listen to economists who are professors. They work at universities. They are neutral.
Yeah.
If you listen to Jamie Dimon from Morgan Stanley Chase, who's the CEO, he's an economist. He's the CEO of a commercial bank. You are gonna get, what's that famous line we knew? You know, when someone whispers sweet nothings in your ear. Yeah, he's gonna flirt with you. He's gonna make you feel all giddy, put butterflies in your stomach. You're gonna feel in love, but he literally fits the template of being a Chad or a Tyrone. You know, he's a player. He's just playing you. However, if you want to deal with reality, you go listen to a professor. Because so far, Helmut, you obviously speak to the neutral professors or the neutral economists here in Namibia.
Yeah.
On a Namibian context, right? But when you talk about global affairs, the economists, you listen to the other economists now, obviously on a podcast or YouTube video somewhere around the world, they will describe to you nuances that you won't easily notice.
Yeah, and the painful part I don't like about, especially, you know, mainstream media is that those are the guys they least talk to.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Let's just talk to this guy who is the head of this and this institution. Just find, an independent, professor at the university. And you can find a lot of those. Every time that someone is looking at, whether it's a local or global economy in relation to the U.S., guys like Jeffrey Sachs, that's the last person they're going to call.
Of course.
Because Jeffrey Sachs is not going to sugarcoat things. He's Richard Wolff. He's going to be like, okay, look,
even Richard Murphy, who does everything from a UK base to like a globalization approach.
Yeah.
Richard Murphy will also tell you straight up, it doesn't make sense. Whatever the politician is saying and whatever the corporates are saying,
it doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So you are right, Helmut. I mean, we also have to look at a scenario like, okay, this Madam Bekele Thomas, she highlighted key facts.
Mm-hmm.
Don't just connect a road to a mine.
Don't just build a road for the sake of building a road.
Exactly.
But what does it connect to?
But the road connects only on the one end to a mine, and on the other end, it's a port. So what does it show the whole country of that country, that African country, the whole population of that African country?
We're back to extraction.
We're back to extraction. We're back to basics. We're playing a very fundamental but basic game known as a strategy. But if you were connecting that mine to a processing center, to another processing center, and then to a port facility or an exit facility, sure, you see the value addition. You see it.
You know that point of well-designed system of connectivity in terms of that basically links transport, trade, and energy that Bekele Thomas pointed out.
Mm.
It took me back to last week's show that I had, and this is on the Gauteng conference.
Yeah,
yeah. The South African deputy president pointed out, he named four main things that should be in place if we want to achieve the goal of industrialization as a continent. And one of the things that he pointed out, the third thing he pointed out was that Africa remains resource rich, but value chain poor.
Yeah.
Now, at that point that Bekele Thomas made where she said, if you look at how we are building infrastructure, it's not congruent with our Africa Continental Free Trade Area. Because take the Lobito Corridor Group, for example.
Mm.
That project is a very extractive, raw extractive shipment outside the continent oriented. And it would make excellent sense in terms of tourism and connecting those three countries so that they can trade with each other better. But, you can't blame the guy that set up the Africa, the guy that set up the rail project.
Mm.
Because connecting Zambia, DRC and Angola was not their goal.
Yeah.
Their goal was to transport copper all the way from Zambia and whatever it is that they're picking in DRC and through Angola straight to the port. That's it. Now, if you want a transport system, for example, that connects those three countries so that they can trade with each other better, fund yours.
Exactly. Or apply a planning that leads to your benefits.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Helmut, if we look at the discussion, like, what is something that I can... Yeah, okay. There was a few articles back in last year and a few video reports that I watched also in 2024 where a whole bunch of Americans and some British economists, but those aligned with and policymakers aligned with governments and entities that are not neutral, cited that, for example, China just building a whole bunch of railway, a whole bunch of road network, but continuously doing this, like every year, they keep adding more road network and they keep adding more railway to their national railway network infrastructure. And some of the particular academics and analysts were citing, yeah, but this will lead to some sort of an economic downturn for the Chinese. Not entirely, Hamoud, because the moment they put in the infrastructure, then they started upgrading. They started doing, you know, processing tenders to upgrade the infrastructure. So now they went from a basic railway line to now a high-speed railway line. From a high-speed railway line, you're now putting up to, what's that new technology they tested in China? The magnetic railway.
The Japanese have perfected that technology. The maglevs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, but the Chinese also have were also researching with one.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the Japanese one is the one on top.
Yeah.
The thing is on the line.
Yeah.
The Chinese have one where the thing is hanging in the air.
One more time.
It's hanging in the air. The magnetic, the whatever you are sitting in. Think about the von Hindenburg.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh yeah, like it's floating on the rail, sort of like in some kind of a confined space.
Yeah, but the cabin is below the railway line.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like a cable car, but not a cable car, but it's supposed to be this futuristic new idea of how to move people.
Mm-hmm.
But at the basis of everything, when you look at trade, Helmut, is about moving people. Now, why is it on this African continent that we think about moving things?
Begele Thomas pointed to that. Now, one thing you have to look at here is we haven't figured out what we are going to trade with each other yet.
Mm.
I don't think we have figured that part out because we don't manufacture anything worth trading with each other.
I think we do, Hamut. Like Namibia. Milk. Beer.
I thought you were going to say salt. No.
The salt even.
Yeah,
there are countries here in Central Africa. They don't have salt processing themselves.
Much of our emphasis is on, is in extractive, and that extractive is shipped in raw form. And the reason behind that, especially in terms of trade.
Yeah.
Of why we have a lot of, trade relations with countries outside the African continent than we do in terms of, intra-continental trade. The best example I can think of that describe or sort of like helps to explain that will be our beef industry.
That too.
Yeah. Well, you're a commercial beef producer, and you're given two options: supply an African continent with questionable buying power and questionable currency strength, or supply a European market with excellent buying power and strong currency. Which one would you go for?
You would obviously go for the one which can reliably pay.
You pick an African country now because of you are a hardcore pan-Africanist. You pick an African country, and while you establish excellent trade relations, the next election cycle, the country is at war. Okay, now what?
Or, let's say it's after the previous election cycle. Now relations get established. Here's the first concern, Hamoud, which is one of my comments that I always bounce back to from when we started doing the home run together was, what is the purpose of international relations, of having a ministry? I'm not talking about our ministry. So if anyone from there is listening, it's not technically about you guys, but it's in general. It's in your line of work that you're doing. So at the heart of international relations is to connect or to seek possible. Firstly, you need to establish peaceful relations with each other. Secondly, you need to build to, you need to advance that relationship to the next phase. What can we potentially, you know, build on together? Is there a possibility for trade? Is there a possibility for something? Because previously, before the First and Second World War, there were countries that signed defensive alliances and offensive alliances. They used to call these things like treaties of aggression or treaties of or defensive treaties. Like Portugal signed it with Great Britain during the Napoleonic Wars, because the Portuguese were afraid of Napoleon. The Spanish were overrun by Napoleon because Napoleon realized that he couldn't trust the Spanish monarchy, the head of the government at the time. And then he sent a French army to literally go in, because there was literally a split happening in terms of the Spanish army at the time. So he sent a French army to literally go and colonize his ally, Spain. And so the British...
For being the ally.
Exactly. Now, if I'm explaining you a situation like this, you get to understand why we've got this discipline of international relations today. Mm. Now, the foreign policy discussion around the world was obviously one currently of the template of globalization before COVID. And for some reason, globalization is now busy fracturing and falling apart. But globalization is slowly being replaced by a multipolar setup known as BRICS. Mm. Why? Indonesia is, how many people was it?
That is going to be 100 and something million.
Wasn't it 160 million? No. It was a lot more. Hamut, wasn't it 300 million? Because we compared it to the United States market.
Mm-hmm. Population size?
Yeah, population size. Indonesia is a massive population. Because Richard Wolff at one stage in one of his presentations kept emphasizing Indonesia.
It's almost 300 million.
Yeah, almost 300 million, because it's 200 and something million.
Yeah.
The US is currently at like 300 million minus all the people they shipped out most since last year up to now.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them incorrectly shipped out. The immigrants most. So, with that particular presentation, Almut, of just those basic facts, Russia sits with almost 200 million, or almost 300 million themselves of people. India is a billion plus. China is a billion plus. Iran sits with 96 million people in their country. South Africa sits with 65 million. Who is the other country also in that BRICS discussion? Brazil. Brazil is sort of like the dark horse in this discussion. Why am I saying Brazil is the dark horse? Because Brazil, Helmut, is the chair and leads Mercosur. You didn't see...
So you get access to Brazil, you get access to South America.
You get access to five other economies.
Yeah.
And Brazil champions Mercosur through that particular discussion you and I covered back in 2024, when our former colleague Justicia went to the Brazilian engagement with the minister at the time, the minister of international relations. It wasn't that ministry. It was with Ministry of Industrialization and Trade, and the discussion coming out of the ambassador of Brazil was, we represent Mercosur, and as Mercosur, we want to strengthen ties with Namibia because we already have good relations with South Africa, but we would like another direct avenue into Southern Africa. Now, why would a country from another continent approach you as Namibia? Why didn't they approach, you know, for the sake of just looking at language-wise, apples with apples, why didn't Brazil approach Angola?
Because they have the same official language. That'd be nice.
No, they already do have the same official language. But in this particular discussion, Helmut, South Africa is here to the south, very large economy, very well industrialized, has got a lot of depth in terms of absorption, providing business, has a lot of resilience themselves. Why didn't the Brazilians try to reinforce things through South Africa? Why did they come to Namibia, who's also part of SACU? And also in SADC.
I think South Africa is already, is already taken by, you know, Colombia.
Huh? No.
Mm.
No.
No, unofficially.
No. What do you mean by Colombia?
Mm? Correct.
Look, Helmut.
Especially Jobek.
Hey, I didn't tell you the story. Back in 2022, I still remember that report very, very, very vividly. So there was a special particular report done on one of their news broadcasts, and I watched the whole event because they played the whole video of the broadcast before the same TV channel now decided to just give you 3 minutes, 2 minutes of the thing. They became clever. They probably knew that there was a Dwight watching their whole broadcast. So, it was an interview specifically about a research report that came out of the heroin trade running from Mozambique through South Africa to the world. Let me say it again. The heroin trade running through Mozambique through South Africa to the world. South Africa became literally
the hub,
the connecting hub for this narcotics. Your
entrance into the African continent.
No, the world.
The whole world.
The whole world, Helmut. Through Mozambique, into South Africa, into the rest of the world. Not Africa, the rest of the world. And
jeez.
I remember on that particular panel discussion of that news program, they had Thabo Mbeki's brother, who I have a book of, Moletsi Mbeki. He's also an economist. And Moletsi literally said, because Moletsi's older brother was president of the country, so he obviously knew of the particular political affiliations between the freedom fighting parties of Southern Africa.
Yeah.
Frelimo of Mozambique, ANC of South Africa, ZANU-PF of Zimbabwe. Those three guys were literally connected on that eastern southern coast of Africa.
Yeah.
And Mbeki himself said, it is astonishing to know of this particular evidence that the ruling party at the time, Frelimo, allowed such a severe negative economic activity to flow through their country into South Africa and out into the rest of the world.
There's a lot of incentives because the drug industry, like the arms industry, it has a lot of money.
Of course it does. And it also is not regulated properly.
And it's not easy to regulate.
Or it has a lot of morally
questionable characters.
Aspects, yeah. Around it in terms of, for example, like the cannabis trade, Helmut. Yeah. Now, I'm sorry for bringing this up. Just a disclaimer, dear listeners. I am interested in the subject matter because of the opposite of the plant. Not the one that gives you, you know, the nice, you know, the feeling one that, and it makes you hungry. Or no, I'm talking about
gets hemp. You speaking patois in 5 minutes.
Yeah, I'm talking about hemp, Helmut. Because yeah. I find hemp-made shirts in South African shops in Namibia. But I have not heard the Namibia Competition Commission, the Namibian police, the Attorney General of this country, the Prosecutor General of this country, anyone come out against South African products of this particular agricultural product, yeah, coming across the border into Namibia. Now, I don't know if it's probably because the NAMRA and the immigration officials on the borders don't know what hemp is. Helmut.
I hope they do, because Helmut, if they don't, Helmut,
you can go now to the shop. You can go now to the service station behind us, ne?
Yeah.
You will find, you know, rollies?
Yeah.
Those papers for cigarettes, mm-hmm, for tobacco,
yeah,
that you can roll yourself when you roll your own cigarette.
Yeah.
You will find hemp-made rollies. It literally says on the box, hemp rollies. And that hemp rollies are the preferred material, because it's I don't know if it's cheaper, but it's a preferred material for that specific producer of the product to make it. It's sold in Namibia. But yet, when we look at how do we advance trade, we don't look at the legislation. We don't understand the legislation, for example, like our lawmakers, not the opposition party lawmakers, I'm actually talking about the ministries themselves,
yeah,
because they also make laws. Which is the executive, sorry. The executive slash lawmakers,
yeah,
they don't look at
Those are your legislatives.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, but the legislatives are almost all the MPs of all the parties in National Assembly.
Yeah.
So I'm saying the executive / lawmakers. Because, you know, Minister of Justice has a drafting division and they've got a law reform division and they advise, you know.
They're just an advisor. Man, these guys, I love their jobs.
Oh, yeah, there's nothing we can do, dude. There's literally nothing we can do. But here's the concern that we're looking at. They don't take into consideration what's happening in the industry and how old a piece of law is.
That brings us back to the alignment between the setup of the physical infrastructure in terms of energy transport and the implementation of the Africa Cornell Free Trade Area. They must be running congruent or parallel to one another.
Exactly.
If not, then you can just talk until Agenda 2063. We'll still be talking.
Now, Helmut, what happens if you don't? Let's say AFCFTA, because according to Bekele Thomas, now, AFCFTA needs to, for it to flourish, it needs to run on a what's the thing's name? On infrastructure that connects markets.
Yeah, yeah.
It shouldn't be fragmentation all over the place, and it shouldn't be arguments like just because we drive on the left hand side of the road and the Angolans on the right hand side of the road, it's an issue to trade. No, it's not an issue to trade. I mean, the Brits and the French drive on opposite side of the road. Yeah. The Japanese and the Chinese and the South Koreans drive on opposite ends of the road. So it's not a train smash. However, in the bigger scheme of things of what we are actually seeing, we have to understand what laws are going to be impacted on both economies. For example, we've got something known as the Credit Agreements Act. Let's say, for example, the Francophone countries of Africa, do they have a similar piece of legislation? Because, Hamad, if you decide now to take, let's say, your clothing brand to which French African... Let's choose... Okay, I don't want to choose a war zone. Let's say you take it to Côte d'Ivoire. Because apparently we shouldn't use the name Ivory Coast. But Côte d'Ivoire translates to Ivory Coast. But let's say you
just
go to...
It's different language. Yeah.
But let's say you go to Côte d'Ivoire. Ne? And you go and inquire, is there a similar piece of law known as the Credit Agreements Act like you know it here in Namibia?
Now, what is the equivalent?
Yeah, what's the equivalent of it? Now, the reason why I'm mentioning the Credit Agreements Act, Hamoud, because we all realize that there is people don't have money for your particular product. Let's say your product costs 200 Namibian dollars.
Yeah.
And not everyone has 200 Namibian dollars for your product every day, for every day's consumption. But how do you move the product? You find a way to move it, because that's actually the aim of the Credit Agreements Act.
Mm-hmm.
Credit Agreements Act, Helmut, is to help the product move off the shelf. You don't wait for payday and everyone shows up with their pay at your till and now you are running out of stock because there's no way of adequately judging and estimating demand.
Yeah.
So the Credit Agreements Act, a lay-by agreement, a hire purchase agreement, facilitates continuous movement of the product. So the stock keeps moving off the shelf.
Yeah.
And you keep ordering from the producer or from the middleman or from the warehouse or from the farmer. And they know, okay, there is this predictable trend being set up. So now we can estimate what demand is like per week, per day, per month. Not the crash sale every end of the month and now you run out of stock, you've got nothing to sell, now you have to close your store at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and then everyone knows, it's a useless business person. What kind of a business are you running where you don't have stock on your shelf? But everyone...
Just when people have money.
Just when people have money. So that's the actual aim of the Credit Agreements Act. It is there to make the product move. Now, why is there a piece of legislation that helps the private sector to stimulate economic activity? Do you know what's the worst part, Helmut? Yesterday I noticed that the South African private sector companies buy each other's companies very often. For example, ShopRite, apparently...
Buy as in shares or as in whole?
No, they buy business units from each other.
Oh, okay.
ShopRite had sold House and Home, the furniture division of the ShopRite group, to the Pepkor group. I noticed it on an invoice of my younger brother. They went and bought something, he and his wife, and I noticed the Pepkor invoice, and I asked them, whose invoice, what did you buy on that invoice? Just out of, because I'm always interested in commercial activity, in industrial design. That's why I always look at like this water bottle and this energy drink in front of us. Yeah. I look at the aesthetics, because we as humans, we are attracted to things that attract our eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Or we respond to something that either it's an alert or it's an attention seeking function. Like, for example,
eye-catching designs. Or...
You always look, Helmut, when you hear police sirens or when you hear ambulance sirens, you always turn your head. Have you ever realized that?
Mm-hmm.
You always look at where is it coming from and what is it doing? What is happening? Is there something around me? You always do that. Don't lie, Helmut. Don't.
Hey, it's a reflex. You're just going to.
I know. Yeah. But you were just sitting there going like, okay, Dwight. Go on.
No, I'm just here thinking about, a police siren.
but still,
yeah.
There's a specific reason why that signals something in your conscious, when you're conscious, and in your subconscious.
Yeah.
You know, you respond immediately. Now, bright colors do the same thing. Your eyes are attracted to bright colors. First thing, here you will see the pink on this bottle. You won't even notice the blue. You'll firstly see these small little pink characters here, and then you go and read, okay, what's the rest of this label saying? Oh, it says Pure Life Mineral Water. That's the product's name, not the company's name.
So behind all the designs and the marketing videos and audios and pictures and everything is a lot of psychological research.
Oh, yes, Helmut. It was a particular branch that was brought into marketing from the psychology side of life. The psychologists literally have had a subject known as consumer buyer behavior, the motivation as to why we make the purchase decisions we make. Why did you buy that hoodie, Helmut? Why did you decide on that cover for your smartphone? Why did you decide on the specific medical aid that you've got for yourself?
Yeah.
Or why did you decide, or why did Dwight decide on this mustard colored notebook he's sitting with?
So there are.
Why did I select mustard? And what do I like about the design of this front cover? Well, it looked intriguing, artistically intriguing. A whole bunch of whatever party scene situation going on in a can of tuna. How do you even describe this? Because it just looks AI generated food to a great extent.
Pretty much, yeah.
But you know, it's right there. So why did you go for it? Why did you decide on a Samsung smartphone, Dwight? Same for you too, Helmut. Why did you decide on Samsung? Wasn't there anything else? What did they give? What makes Samsung better? So all of these discussions, all of these questions are something that the psychologists have looked at since the 1940s or 30s. Because industrialization leads to consumption. And like I said, Helmut, there's one fatal flaw in our economic measurement in Namibia. We don't measure consumption.
Consumption.
Yes, it gets mentioned in the breadbasket analysis by the NSA, but the NSA obviously has to work from limited information because you can read it. They rely on literally going to certain particular sites. Helmut, just this past weekend, I discovered that almost everything in the food basket is cheaper from Rehoboth heading southwards versus Windhoek.
Huh?
Besides petrol, everything else is cheaper. From
the closer you get to South Africa.
Well, not in that scenario in terms of the closer you get to South Africa, but literally moving out of Windhoek, you realize that there are certain benefits. Even the water in your tap is cheaper than in Windhoek.
Oh, yeah, Windhoek is expensive. And the two coastal towns.
Exactly. Now ask yourself the particular question, Amun. When you look at the economics of a situation just from living standards,
yeah,
or cost of living, you go to a scenario, you get to a conclusion of, this is very enticing. Versus now you come to, let's say, Windhoek itself, and you're like, ah, I have to deal with congestion in the town every morning on the way to work. Ah, I've got to deal with, you know, severe prices in the supermarkets. Ah, I've got to deal with, you know, with taxi prices or, you know, public transport prices, which I don't like. Ah, I've got to deal with this. Ah, I've got to deal with that. Ah, I've got to deal with limited space of living. Ah, I've got to deal with excessive high prices for, let's, for example, say rental agreements. Ah, I've got to deal with severe, inflated pricing strategy, pricing for owning a property. Ah, I've got to, it's a lot of headaches. You don't see any positives emanating from it.
No.
However, you do see positives if you were a trust fund baby or you just inherited a whole bunch of serious money from a relative or you had a rich dad who, you know, helped you with your endeavors.
Yeah, that's one thing I don't understand about my generation. Over 6,000 years of recorded history, none of them wanted to, you know, a thought of getting rich. Because old money would have been an excellent idea. But
yeah, it would have been an excellent idea.
Yeah, yeah, but it would have been stolen by the British, so that's okay. Now, look, when you...
That is heavy.
colonialism. They would have stolen all of it. Now, when you look at when you look at trade and in terms of connectivity, even after we get through the hurdle of our isolated energy and transport infrastructure, which is going a different direction from the trade initiatives that we would like to implement. Actually, it's implemented. It's just I don't know how we decided to build trade initiatives and then figured, okay, you know what, how are we going to trade if we don't have the infrastructure? Now, you'd think it would have been like the other way around. First, figure out what are we going to trade, who is going to trade with who and what. Take, for example, Zimbabwe, you know, recently refined at home their, you know, their own lithium.
Mm.
Now, What name one African country that can actually buy that refined lithium, lithium sulfate from Zimbabwe to make it into the iron battery?
Only South Africa.
There you go. Only.
Only South Africa, because South Africa actually owns a localized brand. Eveready.
Yeah.
It's South African.
I have no idea how many times I read that thing is every day, but now
what?
Don't
you just had to come in with a punchline? I mean, you just had, okay. At least you know. At least we're like 3/4 through our show right
look,
now.
Man,
you know?
Look, man. There are a lot of people in my region that will tell you the exact same thing. You have no idea how many times I read that thing is every day. I don't know about other regions, but if it's also the same in a region, then congratulations. English is not a...
Don't worry.
English is not a joke.
We all get it. We all get it. Yeah.
Now, look, the thing is, Namibia is rich in uranium. Zambia is rich in copper.
Mm.
If Zambia, processes, just do their own smelting and processing of copper into something usable, ready to be processed into finished products.
Mm.
If they do that in Zambia, to take for example power cables, who is going to buy it? And if they make it, any country that is rich, for example, in diamonds, if they, after they get all these diamonds from the ground, who is their first African customer? If they have to consider African buyers first, who is their first African customer? And when you look at the reliability component in terms of political instability and currency and economic instability of this particular country, which country is going to stand out in comparison to how a European country, for example, one of the 27 EU member states, for example, like the Norwegians, would stand out?
Mm.
Namibia, according to the, we looked at the February NSA, Namibia's trade statistics.
Yeah.
And the Norwegians seems to have bought a large chunk of Namibia's beef for that particular month. And name one African country that has that level of buying power.
Only South Africa. But there's a concern with that product.
Look, South Africa came in second. Now, if you want, the point I'm trying to make is, if you want to take, for example, motivate Namibia's beef industry, your commercial farmers, those ones that are farming in beef, to participate in the Africa Continental Free Trade Area, to sell their products on the African continent.
Mm.
What are the chances of you convincing them in a way that they do not bleed money in terms of losses?
The first particular thing is, Hamoud, that money has to be exchanged for the product.
Yeah.
Look, in many scenarios, when you look at, firstly, what solidifies trade, for example, between Namibia and the EU is that there is connected financial, I almost said instruments, but it is there.
Yeah.
It started off from Namibia's independence and it has just grown in leaps and bounds. What am I talking about? For example, the tourist from Europe has the opportunity to swipe with their card, their credit card, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They can swipe in Namibia. Why? Because they were told by Namibians on the ground, there's an opportunity to either, if you've got cash on hand,
mm-hmm.
go to a bureau de change and exchange your money for local currency, or you can swipe directly.
Just go to Zambia, there's a bureau de change just across the road.
But that's the problem. Like in Zambia, I saw that what happened, and that was 2010, end of 2010.
I was there in 2017. Bureau de change is still walking around with cash.
Yeah, the money exchanges, they call them.
Yeah.
The concern from those guys was, Helmut, that those guys are sometimes walking around with the old currency notes.
Oh.
The old ones. So what they did is they literally took money out of circulation and they became technically illegal.
They became the circulation.
Yeah. They became the circulation. Yeah. Now, that is the problem with other parts of the African economy. There's too many informal or parallel markets to a formal market. For example, there was one concern, for example, like in the Nigerian context, another report that I watched, that Nigeria has a formal oil trade in its economy, meaning they sell oil or petroleum products into its economy.
Yeah.
But then it has a parallel illegal or informal oil trade into its own economy.
Mm-hmm.
The one is run on Naira, the official one, because it's there to boost and bolster the local currency. The second one, the parallel and informal and illegal one, boosts the US dollar trade. Yeah. So now you've got both US dollar flooding into the market and you've got local currency flying into the market. And the one is stronger than the other one. And the stronger one literally kicks out the other one. So then what is the particular concern? The concern here is, first and foremost, regulation has to become the norm in Africa. It has to become the norm. Helmut, why could the South African government prosecute the Steinhoff cartel for the Steinhoff financial scandal? I won't call it a cartel, because a cartel to me is, it has now become literally synonymous with Western media propaganda versus how they perceive anyone else out of the developing world.
Basically, everyone they don't that agree is not with, European. They will give you a title.
Yeah, everyone that is not European is perceived to be part. If you're part of a cluster of, to the benefit of all of you in that cluster, which doesn't include European or North American,
mm-hmm.
you get called a cartel, or you get called.
As long as we are benefiting, we are giving you a terrible label.
Yeah. But if you become our most preferred partners in development, you are sort of like a godsend.
Yeah.
You are, you know. You are the answer we need. We will help you.
Yeah, look, the comedian Dave Chappelle was explaining after his show in Saudi Arabia.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
He did I never watched that show.
He did a show in Saudi Arabia. And when he got to the US, he was facing.
That was most sort of this year, ne?
Yeah.
Or back in last month, or the month before.
I think it was earlier this year. And now a lot of, including his fellow, I think it was Bill Maher, who was also sort of like criticizing him for performing in Saudi Arabia because, he pointed out, because of the whole Jamal Khashoggi thing, because, Saudi Arabia went to a Saudi, Jamal Khashoggi got into a Saudi consulate in Turkey and then never walked out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so far, that's like sort of like what basically Saudi Arabia has become, basically the new reputation of Saudi Arabia for a lot of Americans.
Mm.
And now a lot of people who were basically critical of Dave Chappelle's performance in Saudi Arabia were pointing to the whole Jamal Khashoggi thing. And well, boy, oh boy, Dave Chappelle being Dave Chappelle was like, okay. And I'm paraphrasing here that, look, I performed in a country that killed one journalist, allegedly. And y'all are okay performing in a country that killed a bunch of journalists, including, and he was talking about Israel.
Mm.
Like,
who is persistently?
Yeah, persistently.
Killing
like,
journalists.
A whole list, you know, journalists, UN member, you know, UN representatives, especially when it comes to UN staff, is, you know, in the... those ones on the ground.
Yeah.
Especially the ones that works with UNRWA.
And emergency services.
Just shoot them. So if you have, I mean, you can't tell me you have a problem with Saudi Arabia because of one journalist, but you don't have a problem with Israel because of a whole list of journalists. If you really cared about journalism.
And targets that should not be military targets. Yeah.
Just the targeting just for the sake of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. The thing is, the legislation, legislation way is, it becomes a problem in terms of enforcement. If it's a written, take for example in Africa, it's going to be very difficult to implement. For one, because, look, the alignment component.
Mm.
The alignment component is one that's going to create a lot of problems because you have, you are writing laws for something that is barely in your grasp.
Yeah.
And one example of that we are going to face is access to information.
Yeah,
access to information, and even if we go to the digital
and data interoperability.
That.
Yeah.
The question is always going to come to where is the data? Meta's data, for example.
Oh, Helmut, have you ever looked at a COVID map when COVID, back in the COVID period?
What is
it? A COVID map of Africa.
No, I haven't.
You won't believe me, but I once did such a particular experiment just to understand why is it just us in South Africa and Africa reporting on COVID deaths and COVID infections and what was that thing that they loved? The tracing, situation.
In terms of infections.
Of further infections. And it was literally three countries here at the bottom of Africa, three countries at the top, absolutely zero in the middle of the continent. Which shows you one particular, and World Health themselves have also said this. There was a lack of reporting structure on many African countries. Now, if you've got a lack of collecting data, processing the data, presenting the data, that means there's literally a gap in planning. So what are you planning for? Hence, Bekele Thomas's speech, which said, please don't build a road for the sake of building a road.
You know what that brought, you know when she said that?
Mm.
I started thinking of two initiatives which we had here in Namibia. That's SME Bank and Peugeot. Because these two initiatives are covered, in my opinion, in a very interesting detail in Mr. Ishobon's The Guide to the Namibian Economy.
Mm.
One, I'm not sure if he says that in relation to Peugeot or SME Bank, but the point he makes is... for the most part, and he's saying this about Namibia, but I think that applies to a large part of Africa. We like to make political promises, which we intend when we find ourselves at that particular office. We feel like now we have to fulfill it to indicate that, you know what, the promises I made at the podium when I was running during my campaigns, I have fulfilled.
Yeah.
And then you end up opening a factory that has no economic alignment with your economy. Take the Peugeot, for example.
Why does it sound like the volunteer workforce at the tannery?
Well, there you go. You said we are going to create employment, and then you create employment that is way out of, that's a way out of line with your, you know, with the overall country's economy. Because, take, like, the Peugeot, for example, is a terrible, but I think Mr. Shevon says that in relation to SME Bank, because there's a part where he's talking about, the central bank being reluctant to offer an operating license to SME Bank, which is, they gave them, a temporary one before they gave them, a legit, you know, operational one, a full one.
Yeah.
And, there was a little bit of political pressure behind it, you know, behind the central bank, basically. If you look at the expertise of the central bank, they were just looking at that and going like, we are just going to give this a period of observation. And now, well, maybe somewhere, somehow, someone made a lot of promises with regards to the implementation within a time frame. Now, Peugeot is another excellent example. You're telling me a group of experts in the field of economics and lawmaking and politics, and we share a lot of trade relations with South Africa more than any country that I know. So you're telling me we didn't know that from the early days, even from the thinking of setting up a Peugeot assembly plant in Walvis Bay, we didn't know that we're going to run into conflict with the South African market because they already offer that product. Now, there are two answers that can come out of that, and none of them is good. One, it's either we knew and we intentionally decided to go with it, which was basically a suicide mission, a very dumb one. Or two, we didn't know, which would also be equally scary, because then if we didn't know about our trade relations with South Africa, what do we know?
I mean, the lovely thing also, Hamoud, about what you see in terms of grand scale economic planning is also, for example, I'm now checking, this is weird. I call it weird because it asks me obviously to pay for a subscription to read the articles. It's an online digital platform known as Hydrogen Insight. And I love the, cause I like seeing the, you know, the latest developments specifically around green hydrogen product, developments in the world. And I'm just reading, just sort of like quoting this one headline that just popped up here because I pressed the wrong button instead of opening up the file I wanted to read from. It notes here specifically that the EU is singling out member nations of the EU for failing to transpose hydrogen targets, meaning report how far you are with your just energy transition.
Yeah.
Report, you know, in terms of the singular approach to achieving a world standard, a global standard. And we are, and Helmut, let's be honest now. The AU's goals, from what we saw from this technical committee on energy and infrastructure, The AU's goals sound similar to what the EU is doing. But remember 2 years back when I explained to you, it seems that AU is operating backwards to front. We went and said yes of being part of a continental program of saying, yeah, let's start the Organization of African Unity, the OAU. And then, yeah, let's change the name to the African Union. Why does it sound like the signaling, the messaging is similar to the EU? Firstly, in labeling.
Yeah.
But then when you look at the groundwork taking place, so we were first chummy with each other without having specific goals and specific targets for each other. Meaning, if I'm going to be in friendship with you, Helmut, what am I expecting from you? And what are you expecting from me? From being two member nations? What are we expecting of each other? Even though you might be sitting in East Africa and I'm sitting in West Africa, what are we expecting of each other? Well, we don't know. We didn't get that far. Then, for some reason, like, for example, what happened to the, what was that thing's name? The air connectivity and something, an air transport memorandum, the Yamoussoukro declaration, where in the 1980s, before Namibia became independent, a whole bunch of African countries went and made promises endorsed by the OAU, endorsed by it, And the moment Namibia became independent, Namibia had to literally say yes to this document because this document preceded Namibia. Namibia's existence. But the downside of this document was, it was once again a piece of paper where people said yes without moving the document into action. So now, Yamoussoukro Declaration was 19... Let me be sure about this. It was 1980 Yamoussoukro...
When it comes to African initiatives like the connectivity of flights and all those things, there's just one elephant in the room.
1988.
What?
1988, the Yamoussoukro Declaration was a landmark policy adopted by African ministers to reform the continent's air transport, aiming to improve cooperation, integrate airlines, and liberalize air services. 1988, 2026.
How good is aviation manufacturing on the African continent?
2008, 2018, 1988 to 1998, 10, 20, 30... We're almost 40 years later. Helmut.
Aviation on the African
continent. I want to bite off my fingers.
Africa's aviation industry is going to struggle in terms of making money. On one side, we are talking about economic inequality on the African continent and how it's pushing a lot of people more and more into poverty.
Mm.
That's one.
Mm.
And two, we want to have these modes of transport from rail to to road to air, so that different Africans can basically travel and trade with each other, using what money?
Exactly.
Because we have economic inequality on one side, which is bad, especially for Namibia and South Africa. And we want these two countries to, to visit each other and basically boost tourism. Tourism means it speaks more into disposable income and a lot of saving. Now, the thing is, right now, you have a lot of people all across the continent who can barely afford bread.
Well, if you brought up the discussion that we did last week, remember the one about
But you want them to hop on a plane and fly and visit each other. How?
Exactly. Remember the other discussion point we had last week about the paramilitary security guards for DRC mines? Ne? You remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
Now,
create a lot of employment for Kavangos, but anyway.
That one too, Helmut. That one too.
Give us passports. Because natural resources is safer than...
That one too. But here's the thing. Now you need a whole bunch of those guys to get on a bus that connects literally to those DRC mines.
Yeah, across Angola.
In between there, the barely passable road network and infrastructure ends in Zambia or ends on the Angolan border with the DRC.
Yeah.
What happens from the DRC border into DRC?
There's this statement that you hear a lot from traditional healers from my region. And the phrase is borrowed from France language.
What, Masubia?
The
other one?
Yeah. Now, I don't know what language specifically is that, but it goes something like Mlima Atuse, which literally translates to may God help or God help. And that's what you're going to be doing as soon as you turn into that region of Katanga all the way to, especially the natural resource rich part of DRC, which also, interestingly, happened to be the most political unstable regions.
Mm.
Look, all you just have to do is go online and you will find a bunch of videos of truck drivers that drive in that region, and they will tell you, it's the most hostile part. You'll go. I think it was late last year or earlier this year when one either Zambian or Zimbabwean, truck driver was killed in that part. Like the lawlessness is insane.
Okay, there's one good point right there. Here's another major scenario to look at. So, one or two of my siblings at one stage they identified that there was a lovely business opportunity. So there's this nice business opportunity, Helmut, where there's a whole bunch of producers from primary resources like agriculture and mining who are looking for as many markets as possible. Now, we discovered, for example, if you go look at like Five Roses tea,
yeah,
it's not produced in South Africa. It's repackaged in South Africa.
Where the heck is it produced?
In Kenya. Now, there's a whole bunch. Now, Kenya is a major tea producing country.
Yeah.
You can, like, you can order the tea leaf in a container, ne?
Yeah.
But you have to decide whether it, you have to order a ship. You have to send the ship. Not the container be put on a ship that incidentally or accidentally comes to Walvis Bay.
Mm-hmm.
You have to order the ship.
Yes.
You have to order your container. Or do you send a truck driving all the way from Namibia to Kenya?
To Kenya.
And I still remember the lovely phrase that, that one of my siblings was told by a trucking company here in Namibia who said, he said in Afrikaans, basically. The phrase was, daar's 'n probleem om 'n trok te stuur. Ek weet nie wat gebeur om my trok daai kant van die grens nie. Meaning, there's no problem in sending a truck past the Namibian border into Zambia. But he said, but he literally said, outside of Namibia, Botswana, and South Africa, there is no guarantee, because they were asked, they were quoted a price for like something like 10,000 a kilometer.
Holy cow.
To insure the truck.
Yeah.
Helmut, to insure the truck. Because you don't know what happens.
Per kilometer.
Per kilometer. You don't know.
How many kilometers, how many kilometers from here to Kenya?
A couple of thousand. No, I'm lying. A few thousand. Because a few means 5,000. A few thousand kilometers. So the concern was, there's great risk.
Yeah.
The insurance on that truck is going to be astronomical because that guy has to inform his insurance company of where this truck is going.
Yeah.
So that his insurance company understands the risk. So that if something goes wrong, he gets his money paid out for the value of the truck and the truck driver's life. Because he's sending a Namibian as well.
Yeah.
He's not sending a Zambian hired on the other side of the border or a guy, a Kenyan over there who knows all the... No,
because
he's sending...
Because now you're looking at a whole another level of logistics of getting the driver from Kenya to here and then he drives.
Exactly. Or it's an... And it's plus, it's a Namibian driving with an empty truck all the way there to go and get and then has to drive back. One of the loveliest stories I ever heard, and I call it lovely, my elder brother, this, when the Darfur conflict broke out, so he hitched hikes from Mozambique through Zimbabwe into Botswana with a guy from Botswana who went to Mozambique and drove with his car, his Mozambican number plate car, with his Botswana number plate car from Mozambique to Namibia. Now, the Botswanan guy was actually in Tanzania. Sorry. He came through Tanzania into Mozambique from the north into Mozambique. This guy had gotten all those exotic fruits there in Tanzania, because in Tanzania, the mangoes and the bananas grow like the weed. Okay. Not cannabis weed. Like you see these plants here,
everywhere.
It's growing wild. So you can just pull over and pluck off,
I saw that with mango in Zambia.
Yeah. Now imagine the same thing from Zambia heading that way to the Indian Ocean. So this guy had a boot full of fruits and stuff.
Mame.
And at every roadblock for four African countries, he was paying bribes with the fruit in his boot.
Oh boy.
Just to get past the checkpoints. They see your number plate. Now the...
It's not local, so it's an opportunity for them.
Now you get extorted. So now you have to bribe a immigration officer or police officer or from Zimbabwe or from Mozambique. That was now what? When did the Darfur conflict happen? 2008, 2009?
Didn't that conflict run all the way into 2015?
Yeah, but its actual start.
Yeah.
Its actual start was there, 2008, 2009,
thereabout.
And when my brother came back a year later, and he literally explained it to us, he said, the most phenomenal thing he's ever seen was literally how this guy from Botswana had to bribe at every roadblock with watermelons, potatoes, bananas, mangoes, cabbages. What was the other fruit he also had? There was a whole bunch of other stuff.
Are you that broke though?
But dude, you need to throw in petrol. Why do you need to pay with your money? I'd rather bribe you with a tomato than bribe you with my actual money, because I need the petrol at the next station.
No, I'm saying as a police officer.
I have to tell you another story of another guy that worked with the same sibling here in Namibia. And in nature, he tried to drive with his Angolan girlfriend back to Angola. and his car got impounded on the border. There was nothing wrong with him, with his documentation, everything.
There's nothing wrong with the car, with his
documentation. Nothing. The girlfriend at the time that told him that these guy, immigration officials of Angola were looking for a way to extract as much money from him. And then the stories came out that sometimes the Angolan government forgets to pay their own officials. I use that word loosely, but it was a reality of a victim of something literally on a board at trying to get from Namibia into Angola. He was a Swedish. He's a Swedish national.
Oh, he's white. Oh, that's worse.
Yeah. And they were trying to find every opportunity of keeping him there on the border.
Yeah, because everyone just looked at him. Oh, he's white. He must have foreign currency.
And the poor girlfriend he had at the time was defending him around every corner from being arrested. Literally, they were that far to literally just arrest him. Now, here's another concern, Helmut.
It's that bad.
It's that bad. That's how bad immigration between African countries are. Obviously, he's a European, né? And obviously for us Africans, it's a little bit looser.
So that means, for one, you should start with
sorting out
the security issues.
Yeah. Basic immigration, movement of people, which is the other, remember the other declaration?
Yeah.
The movement, the Yamoussoukro declaration was based upon another AU declaration, the movement of people declaration.
Yeah.
But Namibia is not interested in solving. Yeah, we made that statement 2 years back. Remember before Albert Kawana left office?
Mm.
The one about the reciprocity in terms of visa on arrival.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch of African countries are on the good list, the green list.
Mm.
And most of the actual tourism market for Namibia is on the red list, which is most of EU nations.
It's interesting.
The United States and Canada and the UK. And then China obviously got the one of last year, that weird one, where only officials get like immediately to be allowed to come through.
Yeah.
Even Japan is on that red list. Australia is also there. But here's the thing. Much of the market, the tourism market, comes from the red list. And in terms of the green list, it's either Angola, Zimbabwe, Botswana, or South Africa. That's it. That is as far as Namibia's African connectivity.
What does that speak to? Affordability.
Exactly.
Now, look, you can connect as much electricity grid and as much roads and as much air connection. Actually, it's going to reach a point where it's unsustainable to maintain, because the people that are supposed to be using it can barely afford bread. Right? Well, that's not rocket science. 8 minutes in the 8 minutes in the hour of 8 minutes in the hour of five. And if you just tuned in, this is Home Run with Helmut and Dwight on Eagle FM. Let's take a quick break and we'll come back on the other side and continue. Please do. Sometimes we just get carried away and just forget that we need to, you know, breathe and drink water.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have a capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that does not have a capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Ipurane ngelo wapubwa Eva Tere ulikoni maundu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutite okoye ekukulile. Oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo ihewetike kovano hile koshuwala. Onongeshe faa ya pumbo kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu kondado inawa. nune udo o tukwetera o special ange tashake ngeje pa o marudi dayo loka o kone ujendi fenawa nokumona o ijamo ili nawa ninge kwata fanona monika ko Eagle FM onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile ko derewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu o mafilane Eagle FM the eye.
Welcome back, but before continue, let's take a live read. Velvicia University 2026 July applications are now open. Faculty of Health Sciences, a postgraduate diploma in community health nursing level 8. Admission requirements: have a recognized nursing qualification at NQF level 7 or higher from any recognized higher learning institutions. Must be a registered nurse slash midwife with a Nursing Council of Namibia HPCNA. Minimum of 2 years working experience as a nurse slash midwife in any health facility. Must write a short essay describing the motivation for pursuing postgraduate diploma in community health nursing. Qualification duration, 1 year. Mode of delivery, full time. For more information, please call 081-403-6406. Velvicia University, where everyone is an achiever. Now, in the just the last 5 minutes, one thing that we are not talking about in terms of connecting Africa and trade and achieving all kind of, economic prosperity, inflation is always going to go the northern direction. That's one. So that's also going to feed into the economic inequality. That's leaving aside the fact that this is one thing that I also pointed out last week or just on Sunday that I just recently observed, and this is just my own observation. There's a lot African countries in terms of African governments can learn from Western governments in terms of how they safeguard the interest of their private sector. When Dangote opened, inaugurated his, basically opened up and started running his refinery, the biggest hurdle he had to go through was the Nigerian government. I'm like, what on earth is going on here?
And the worst part was even that a former Nigerian president had to come and explain that the oil majors that are present in the Nigerian economy did not have the refining capacity that the Nigerian government wanted to materialize.
Yeah.
They were literally subsidizing the guys. They had to pay. The Nigerian government had to pay. Now, when you see a template like that where a local businessman is trying to practice trade replacement, meaning let's produce our own value addition. Why don't we reinforce what we're doing and build to local content policy development? Then you've got a big issue, Helmut. Go to South Africa. The South Africans are supporting South Africans. Yes, they've got their internal squabbles. Yes, in some cases.
Ones are always going to be there.
It might be borderline racism in many of them. Don't worry. But that's South Africa. They are resilient. The question is, economies like Namibia, like Nigeria, like Botswana, like in Angola, we've got certain particular issues. And these particular issues, Helmut, you can immediately see what is the issue and what is the possible, positive outcome that you can apply to it.
Yeah.
And please, guys, don't have volunteer workforces at a tannery who then say, no, we own the product. We just don't know who's in charge.
Yeah,
but we're all volunteers, which is against the Namibian constitution. You may not work for free. So who's in charge?
Well, out of the love for our wonderful land of the brave, we're just doing it for free.
For free.
Yeah. And we're just so kind. Say that, or we're just, tannering our own leather in the middle of the night. No one is going to work for free, not in this economy. I'm not falling for that.
You're tanning in the middle of the night. True. Yeah, no, I mean, true. But yeah,
Look, I'm just saying that's exactly what I'll be doing.
Standing in the middle of the night?
Look, I have to get to that workplace from my house. There's no taxi driver that's going to transport me from my house to that place every day for free.
And the sand is thick over there, ne? So having a bicycle doesn't work.
Yeah, it doesn't count.
Even if you've got Lance Armstrong legs, ne? You just won't make it. Just believe me, you won't make it in that cycle race. But yeah, Helmut, you are right.
For me, it's always going to boil down to one thing, the affordability component. We first have to figure out ways to make sure that a lot of people across the continent have disposable income, because right now, 90% of us are in survival mode.
Yeah.
And there's no way we're going to visit each other's countries or come up with business that are big enough to conduct cross-border trade, so we can trade with each other if we are in survival mode. The biggest business model in a lot of African countries is someone starts a business and just look up to government tenders, which is not a good one, if you ask me. But if you look at, Namibia, for example, has this more like a confusing template of... let's have the private sector and the public sector basically work in collabo, where the private sector, the public sector has the need, the private sector has the expertise. Let them complement each other with the right regulations in place, because if you're going to work with the private sector, you must have a good enough regulation in place. Where the public sector also has its own weaknesses in terms of paying on time, which is one thing that the private sector in Namibia thinks a lot about. And the
I've heard of invoices going unpaid for 3 years. How much?
3 years.
Yeah.
How am I supposed to run my business?
When I tell you I worked in advertising, the clients I had from the private sector would say, at that stage, this was literally after 2015, after Gein Gop's first term, after he came into office, 2015, and in between there we were also. That we were upgraded to the middle income classification.
Oh, yeah.
Remember last year we got downgraded to the lower income, lower middle income classification?
Yeah.
Now, as Gein Gop got sworn in, we were reclassified into an upper middle income country.
Mm.
That meant we couldn't access the cheap financing that we needed for further developmental programs. And now with President Nandi Ndaitwa, we obviously got reclassified down to a lower middle income country. Now we can access a whole bunch of cheap, loans for developmental projects.
The interesting thing is that's when we started paying off all our loans. And we just excellent at this.
Actually, that's true. That is true.
Namibia is a genius.
Well, technically, it's luck. It's pure luck.
Yeah.
Something happened between last year when that reclassification happened and up to now.
Yeah.
It's pure luck. But we still have to prove the luck.
That's why I'm giving my government credit on this one.
It's very suspicious. 10 years after the reclassification there in Gein Gop's first
upgrading,
term,
yeah.
that we are regraded here with President Nandi Ndaitwa's literally her first year. It's not even her first full 12 months. Her first 8 or 6 or 7 months.
Yeah.
We get reclassified to lower middle income. Okay. So as we obviously look at the particular concerns that, that exist, the scenario we're faced with is a scenario of how do we make the private sector grow and flourish. How about on the way here, I had a wonderful idea. I remember once, sorry, Uncle Buana, if I'm sort of like signaling to you, but once at a time when I did the business and economic segment, we were talking about business ideas, and I told Uncle Buana once, obviously when he called through that one stage, at any time of the day, any time of any year, I had one stage set with like 6 or 5 business ideas. And at every hurdle of them, it's either collateral that's an issue, access to financing, and actually presenting the idea. But you would not believe me, Ahmed, when you go look into society in Namibia and you would recognize how many actual business ideas actually exist on a ground level. Jeez. And it has got nothing to do with food. Please, guys, stop off. Stop talking about food trucks and braai stands and kapana stands and selling vegetables next to the side of the road. Everyone is now selling the vegetables next to the side of the road. It is not a feasible strategy for anyone. Not anyone can tap into it. Not anyone has the patience to go and sit next to the road and sell vegetables. Please. In some cases, we need to look at fully fledged enterprises. However, we'll quickly take a short break, guys, and we'll come back right after this.
Lipurane ngeno wapumbwa Eva Tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutite opoye ekukurile Oshafa fana nongeshefa ili unehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana Onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa Nune udo otukwetira o special angeta shake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka Opone ushendi fenawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa Ninge Patafanona, Monica, Co, Eagle FM, Honore Tatime, Bali Heali, Nola Natu, Heali Bali, No Heali, Ileko Berewa, Nora Hetatu Natu, Bali O Hetatu Matatu, Oma Felane, Eagle FM, The Eye.
Welcome back. 5 minutes into the Hour of Business and Economic segment. Of course, that brings us to the end of Home Run for today. Until tomorrow, same time, same place. You'll have a blessed Kasinga Remembrance Day evening.
And from my side, guys, remember that obviously tomorrow we bring you just as well as similar enthusiasm, but nonetheless, stay fresh. Yes, yeah. That's the best I could say, Hamud, stay fresh.
Remember tomorrow, yeah, stay fresh for tomorrow.
I hope no one feels like a freshly caught hake or, you know, some sort of marine product. I'm sorry for that if you're thinking about the freshness. Yeah.
All right.